ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
To the amazing world of assisted reproduction, how it has over nearly half a century now allowed millions of people around the world to start families that they otherwise would not have been able to. It's enabled older women to have children. Dr. Trish Davies began her medical career as a busy general practitioner with special interests in women's health, especially gynaecology and menopause, children's health and surgery. And to further her interests and experience, she spent 3 years in London and Scotland undertaking further training in obstetrics and gynaecology, anaesthetics, paediatrics, family planning, and work with a whole lot of people. In 1991, she began working in reproductive medicine in Adelaide's Wakefield Hospital and in a public unit at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, becoming, she believes, the first GP-trained doctor to work in the specialist field of reproductive medicine in Australia. And from 2005, she's worked at the ReproMed, one of the first purpose-built assisted reproduction units in Australia. So she's pretty much seen it all over the years, and witnessed firsthand the changes in science, techniques, and the much improved success rates in fertility that this branch of medicine now offers. You might have questions about it, so make sure you give me a call. If you do, 1-300-800-222. There are lines free. Trisha Davies joins me this evening. Dr. Davies, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Philip, and thank you very much for having me.
That's terrific to have you, and thanks for your expertise as well. Take us back to 1991. IVF was happening back then. What was it? What was involved?
Well, first of all, before I talk about IVF, I'd just like to mention that in reproductive medicine, that there are also many other simpler treatments available to people trying to conceive.
Of course.
So I just
We are going to talk about those as well. That's right.
Is that okay?
Yeah. No, don't worry. I want to talk about everything.
So, okay. Yeah. So I just would love people to know that coming to a reproductive medicine clinic is not just going straight to IVF.
No.
There are many other processes and treatments. For example, things like inducing ovulation, where a woman may not ovulate at all or ovulate infrequently, timed intercourse. With timed intercourse, as well as another treatment where we insert sperm directly into the uterus, called, of course, intrauterine insemination. And this also treatment can be as simple as timed intercourse after some blood tests. So there are a few other options. It's not just all assisted reproduction and IVF.
No, that's right. Exactly. There are other ways to do it. IVF at the kind of most technological end of these technologies, I guess, is it?
Certainly. I mean, the other treatments can be very effective depending on the issue of the people involved.
Mm. When you started, tell me about, maybe we should start with that. Tell me about the technologies when you started.
Well, we had all the initial treatments that I said, but also IVF itself, in vitro fertilisation or fertilisation of eggs and sperm outside the body is the technical definition, or fertilisation in glass is what in vitro means.
Mm. Yeah.
And this back then, and really still now, back in the early 90s, before any further technologies, we did what we now call standard IVF.
Mm-hmm.
When that involved about 2 weeks for the female having injections every day and blood tests and scans, but the injections back then were intramuscular. So that meant that the women had to come into the clinic every single day, which of course added a lot of time pressure and consequent stress. So IVF, when I started, that was basically it. The woman was stimulated with the injections, and when the woman was ready, she'd have what we call a trigger injection, which mimicked ovulation. And the eggs were taken under sedation in the operating theatre.
How do you collect the eggs?
through the vagina wall under ultrasound straight into the ovary. You can see the follicles. They look like big, dark circles on the ultrasound, and generally it's a very easy procedure. You have the ultrasound with a needle and needle guide attached, which goes straight through the vagina wall into the follicle, and then we apply suction and drains the follicular fluid, and then that goes into the test tube, hence test tube baby, and goes to our embryologist or scientist in theatre to check for eggs.
Okay, once you've got the eggs, what happens then?
Well, then eggs, partner or donor produces a sample of sperms and they're in the laboratory, they're put together. And back in the 90s, it was weighted, and we still do standard IVF. It still produces very good pregnancy rates in the right people. The fertilisation of the eggs with the sperm was watched for a couple of days in petri dishes, and then if there was a viable embryo, it would be put back into the partner, generally day two or three back then. We don't actually do day two or three embryo transfers anymore, because science has told us that if the embryo can grow to day four or five, there's a much higher chance of survival or pregnancy.
Okay. So at day four or five, then they're put back into the uterus, are they? How does that happen?
Just under, with the little catheter through the cervix into the uterus, just like basically like having a pap smear. No anaesthetic involved or anything else. But of course, back in the 90s, our knowledge of the tubal environment and the liquid that surround the embryos, both in the petri dish and eggs and sperm, our knowledge was very different to what it is now. So, you know, basically now we would put one embryo in nearly 95% of the time. But back then, because the pregnancy rates were way less than half of what they are today, we would sometimes put two embryos back and occasionally a third, resulting, of course, in multiple births,
yeah. What's these days, what's the success rate of this compared to when you started?
Depends really on the age of the female undertaking IVF. Really depends whether she's under 30, 30 to 35, 35 to 38, 40 plus, etc. But under 35 is generally 40-ish percent, 45. Under 30 can be as high as 60 or 70. But back then it was about 20, 22. Not very high. But I just want to say there was another procedure we did back in the 90s that's no longer done, which had a very high success rate, and that was a thing called GIFT. And that's an acronym standing for gamete intrafallopian transfer. So basically a woman would have an egg collection in the normal way, but it would be under general anaesthetic, a full general, and then she, under laparoscopy, would have fresh eggs and sperm put back into the fallopian tube. And this could be up to 60% pregnancy rate. But, of course, what do you do with the rest of the eggs and sperm? And it was a lot more invasive than a routine IVF cycle. And that hasn't been done now around the world, I think, since the end of the 90s, because of the success of IVF.
Yeah, normally. When you say success, so it has a success rate of what? You say if you're under 35, a success rate of about 30 to 40%? Is that right?
Yes, generally, but it really depends on why someone's having the procedure, what their ovarian reserve is.
What about when
multifactorial, obviously, but generally 30 to 40%, 30 to 35.
If you're 40 years old, the success rate drops down to about what?
5%. Over 42, it might be 5, 4, not very high. Over 43, very few. Over 45, about zero, 40 to 42, depending again on the patient, 5 to 10.
The thing that, you know, the so-called biological clock, which women often feel ticking for them, is... Talk to me about that. It's a real thing to some degree, and to a very large degree, isn't it?
Oh, it's a very real thing. When women are born, they're born with about 2 million eggs, but by the time they reach puberty, they're about 400,000. And then they continue to decrease both in quality and quantity. So by the after 36, it dramatically decreases again. So chances of spontaneous pregnancy after that, and then again after 40, as I've said, really decrease.
These days, women increasingly are delaying childbirth until they're over 30, aren't they? I mean, probably between 30 and 35. I don't know what the figures are. I don't know when the most women are having children these days, but... you get the impression that a lot of women are leaving it till by the time they're 30, somewhere between 30 and 35 to have children, compared to, say, you know, mid to late 20s, which was the case some generations ago. Is that right?
Absolutely, and the figures are there. I don't know what the figures are exactly, but there's been a huge societal change in women starting their families later. I'm sure career, finances... You know, many factors, but there has been a big societal change. We see many women coming in to start their families over 30, over 35, etc. And that's probably why freezing eggs has become into vogue as well.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Lines are free if you want to grab a line. G'day, Brian. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, Phil, and hello to your guests this evening.
Tricia, yeah.
Tricia, yes, good evening. My question is Octomum. I believe that was her nickname. I don't mean to be rude there. I don't know her name, but I believe the old methods were used, a combination of multiple eggs put back into her, and some of those eggs with the fertility drugs extra division. So she, I mean, I find it amazing there might be eight of these kids all fitting inside, of course, a uterus. But I'm just wondering what information you have on that, and how it happened, and haven't heard much of her of these days. So, yeah.
Thanks, Brian. Fortunately, that's not an Australian norm. We are very protocoled and procedured. And we would never put back. She would have had embryos back, and I'm not sure exactly how many she had back, whether she had six or seven or eight or how many, and how many became twins. So whether she had six back and two lots of twins, I'm not sure of those details. But in America, which is where this happened, you were allowed to, their laws were very different to ours, and they were allowed to put in multiple embryos. Whether they still do, they still don't do as much, but they still put in more than we do.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
Pleasure.
Yeah, they still put in more. So what, so the rate of multiple births from IVF is higher in America than it is here, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact figures, to be honest, Philip.
1-300-800-222 is the number. When I don't want to spend the entire conversation on IVF, of course, but what's the typical reason for going down this path? Is it because one of the partners is not fertile, or is there some other reason?
Many reasons, of course. The two most common reasons, number one is the age of the egg or the age of the woman. Also male infertility. It used to be thought years ago that majority of infertility was a woman's issue. Well, not now. It's nearly 50-50 in male and female infertility of causes. So causes, you know, decreasing egg quantity, quality, age, endometriosis, adenomyosis. With males, there's a whole gamut of things. Women also may have polycystic ovary syndrome, where they have a large number of potential eggs sitting in their ovaries, but they may not ovulate.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many causes.
Can you tell, if you sample an egg from a woman who's having trouble getting pregnant, whether the eggs are the problem or not?
No, that's a very difficult thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
It's usually, if it's an egg factor, with the male test being normal, it's generally a decrease in fertilisation following fertilisation of an egg that would make you think it was an egg factor. Also, it might be she may have a very low ovarian reserve test, which is a thing that was invented in Adelaide at our clinic in 2004, first worldwide, a thing called AMH, which is a blood test. It's just a simple blood test. I think it costs about $100 to assess the quantity of eggs in an ovary that a woman has. And this is a good indicator of a woman's fertility potential, but also helps diagnose polycystic ovary syndrome, because people have a very high AMH, obviously, because they've got a lot of potential eggs sitting there, and also guides us in IVF treatment and what dose of injections to give a female. So it's been that has been one of the major breakthroughs. It was the ovarian reserve testing.
This can be in a, I mean, it's a hugely emotionally charged area. I'm well aware of that, and I've have spoken to people in you know, in my life who've had difficulty, well, who have not been able to conceive, and who've never really been provided with an explanation as to why, despite, you know, all sorts of tests. Is that still the case, that, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen?
That's obviously possible, especially in older women. Generally, less and less, Philip, of undiagnosed, because genetics in the last 20 years has made has really come to the fore.
Right.
And we now do carrier screening, looking at the genes people carry, both the male and the female. Embryos are can be tested for their genetic component or chromosomes, whether they are normal embryos or not. So, yes, no,
Well, I mean, I'm often, whenever I've looked at the matter, I'm often struck by the wonder that anyone gets pregnant, given the process involved, and, you know, the need for tiny sperm to travel long distances to impregnate the female egg. I wonder whether sometimes you look and think, well, look, the sperm seem to be okay, the eggs seem to be okay, we don't know why you can't get pregnant. Is that, you think that these days you probably aren't going to get that puzzled reaction?
Yes, you are. Yeah, right. We've had it many times, called unexplained infertility,
right.
And it's a real thing. We have normal eggs, normal egg count, normal sperm, and they don't get pregnant. So then, of course, you go further and you do a lot more tests, a lot of rarer tests, immunological tests, test the inside of the uterus. There are many things to be done, but, yes, occasionally some people just don't get pregnant. But also, the converse, sometimes it's all about the number of times you have an embryo put back in increases your pregnancy chances.
Right. Is it the case that if the embryo looks normal and the sperm looks normal, that and the couple can't get pregnant, that the chances of the of successful impregnation would improve in the test tube, or in other words, can you make it happen in the test tube where it may not be happening in the body, for example?
Oh, definitely.
Right.
Definitely. A male has a decreased sperm count, being whichever factor that we check. Sometimes they don't fertilise the egg so well. So therefore, may need a process called microinjection or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, ICSI, which is commonly called, which was invented, started in the early 90s. And in Adelaide, we had the first Australian ICSI baby at Wakefield Street.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a huge breakthrough.
So this and this involves the direct injection of sperm into the egg to achieve
fertilisation. Yes, it does, by the scientists, embryologists.
Right, and that then that embryo is implanted back into the uterus.
If it survives. Not all embryos survive. You might start off with 10 eggs and inject them all, and a normal fertilisation rate would be 60%. And then out of that, you might get two or three embryos, maybe one. The best one would go back, and then if you have any others that are still there that are capable of achieving a pregnancy, well, then they would be cryopreserved or frozen.
Mm. I'm talking with our guest, Dr. Tricia Davies, who's a fertility clinician. We're talking about the history. I mean, Tricia's been there almost from the beginning, retired a month or so after more than 30 years working in the field, and has pretty much seen it all up till today, where these technologies have improved a great deal. 1-300-800-222 is the number if you'd like to ask a question or maybe have a comment yourself. Sophie from Holsworth is with us, who's an IVF mum. G'day, Sophie.
Hi, Sophie. How are you? Hello. Thank you for your work. So I'm a single mum by choice, so I use donor sperm to do my IVF. I tried two unsuccessful IUI things, and then when I started in my early 40s. So
early 40s?
I tried to do it the traditional way and, you know, find someone, but that didn't work out. So, yeah, then I did my IVF cycles. My first cycle, I ended up with two embryos out of seven. One had chromosomal abnormalities, so I was left with one. Unfortunately, that one didn't work out. My second cycle, I ended up with five. Two had abnormalities and the other two were fine, and one, they didn't get enough to get an accurate result. And they implanted those two, and I've ended up with twin boys.
Hey.
Yeah. I have to say the IVF process, doing it by yourself, is very, very hard mentally, physically. It is not an easy thing to do, also financially. It's pretty full on, but you get there in the end. I know plenty of single moms and some lesbian couples that have used IVF, and it's wonderful. So, yeah, there was a lot of...
How old were you, Sophie, when you got pregnant with the twins?
43.
43?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I started in my 40s, all the extensive testing you had to do for IUI, making sure your fallopian tubes are working, you know, all the variety of tests that you have to get done. And then, you know, also just waiting for your cycle, like you've got to wait for your cycle to come before you can start doing something. And then, you know, you do your round, and then, you know, my embryos went to like day six, day seven, and then they, you know, took some cells out to test them and they freeze them. And a month later you find out what's come of them all. So, yeah, you know, the ones that had chromosomal things, they discarded, obviously. But I had one untested, but after having twins, I don't want any more. So I was like, you can discard that one. I'm not going to pay the $1,000 to get it retested and rethought and then tested and refrozen.
It's an expensive process, Sophie, isn't it? How much do you reckon it cost you in the end?
About $70,000.
Wow.
Whoa.
On a single income
as well.
So I know people that have accessed their super to pay for it, and, you know, it doesn't guarantee you with a baby at the end of the day.
No.
So, you know, for numerous reasons. But as a, you know, doing this, my donor had extensive genetic testing and I had extensive genetic testing to make sure that we were compatible. So we both didn't carry recessive things that would end up with, you know, a baby with abnormalities or syndromes and stuff like that. And I used a donor bank in America, so which have amazing profiles. You know, you can pick height, hair colour, eye colour, all of it. Whereas the Australian donors, you don't get much information at all. You go in there with a shopping list, really.
Sophie, can I ask you what state you're in and which bank in America you used?
California Cryobank, and I'm in New South Wales. Yeah, through Monash.
Sophie, thank you. Thanks for sharing the story and good luck. How old are the boys?
There'll be two at the end of January.
Hey, Sophie, you don't have time to talk to us.
I've just finished folding the washing, doing the washing up. I'll get to bed eventually.
I know. From two to four is, let's say, to put it politely, a busy time.
Yes, it definitely is.
All right.
Congratulations on your boys, Sophie.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your work.
Good on you,
so women out here appreciate it.
Thanks, Soph. Good on you. Bye bye. 1-300-800-222 is the number. My guest tonight is Dr. Tricia Davies. We're talking about fertility, the history of fertility, and so on. You talked about egg freezing a minute ago, Trish. This has become more of a thing recently, hasn't it, or is it older than that?
Eggs have been frozen for 35-plus years.
Right.
However, previously it used to do a slow freezing, and they take them down to about 165 degrees Celsius, roughly. But with that, the egg is actually the biggest cell in the human body, the oocyte or egg, and it has a lot of water. So back then, the thaw survival rates weren't very good until vitrification or rapid freezing of eggs was introduced. And this has been a major breakthrough, and now it's close to about 100% survival rate. So that has been fantastic.
Okay.
And I think with the delay, with a lot of couples, women, the societal change of having babies later, egg freezing is a fabulous thing. A couple of things. First of all, obviously, for people coming in who may be single but don't want to use donor sperm in their 30s, decide to freeze their eggs because it's better to freeze your eggs then than wait 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. And I've got one patient actually who, well, an example of a patient who came to me single at 36, froze her eggs, then met her now husband at 42, and they had already tried, by the time they came to me, they'd been trying for 6 to 12 months, say, I can't remember exactly how, but they'd been trying on their own. So then we thawed her eggs, fertilised them with his sperm, and she has a baby at 43 and another one on the way.
The advantage of this is what? That you can freeze your eggs when the eggs are more viable and healthier. When you unfreeze them, they retain those benefits, do they? Is that the idea?
Oh, absolutely. It's all about the age of the egg.
Yeah,
so basically she had 36, we put embryos made from a 36-year-old woman back into a 42, 43-year-old woman, but the chance of pregnancy is the same as if she was 36, not 42 or 3.
Oh, okay. Lauren from Tamworth. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I'm 31. I got diagnosed with PCOS when I was 18, and I got put on birth control, which is the standard for it. And, you know, your doctor says, well, come back when you want to get pregnant. And at 30, I finally got off it. And because of a few lifestyle factors of, like, financial and things, I'm planning on trying to get pregnant around 34, 35. And I was wondering, like, should I start with the IUI then, or do I just skip ahead and go straight to the IVF, which is more invasive, but would it have better results? I mean, it's one of those of, do we go for the less invasive and then possibly 12, 24, 36 months and then finally go for the invasive?
That's a very good question. Have you had any testing, and are you with a partner?
No, I'm single and I'm planning on doing the single mum by choice route. And I'm also planning on hopefully having two children because I believe that there are some lessons you can only learn from having siblings.
Mm.
And I've also decided there's no man in my life that I want to be my donor, because when it comes to things like, well, let's say I wanted to move to the other side of the world, are they really going to keep their mouth shut? I want to raise my kids with my morals, my ethics, and didn't want someone interfering. So I was planning on getting an anonymous donor or sperm bank and then doing it that way.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. Lauren, Trish, what's the... I mean, is there a comparison you can briefly offer us as to IUI and IVF?
They are different pregnancy rates. And in Adelaide, because donor sperm now is, we need a lot more donor sperm, especially locally.
Mm.
But if you get sperm from, say, America, California Cryobank, or Seattle, or any of those places, it's an expensive process. But using donor sperm itself is still an expensive process. So the pregnancy rates with IVF are about triple of what they are with IUI. So you might have one IVF cycle, have an embryo back, perhaps get pregnant or not, but perhaps get pregnant. But then you can have frozen embryos with that cycle. So if the only reason that you are not getting pregnant is through lack of a partner, that is what we have been doing at RepraMed for a few years, because the success rates compared to IUI are so much greater.
Okay.
Does that answer your question a bit?
Yes, it does.
Hmm.
But also, if you're using your own eggs, you know, I don't know what your financial situation is, but the earlier you start, the more likely you are to have two children.
Well, at this point, I am fully prepared to walk into the bank, get a personal loan, and then let's just go for it and get the health fund on board and do it that way.
Sure.
Do you have superannuation?
I do, and depending on how much it would cost, like, remember when everyone was taking like 10 grand out of their super during COVID?
Mm.
Someone actually calculated for someone my age, if I took the 10 grand out, by the time I retire, that would have been like over $200,000 gone. So it's one of those, that financial definitely plays a part in it of, do I take it now but then possibly suffer a little bit in the future?
Yeah, I'd get some advice on that, Lauren, because...
I would too. And most clinics, Lauren...
You should take money out of your super, probably, with great caution. So I'd get some advice on it, yeah.
Thank you.
Lauren, most clinics have different forms of financial payment, whether I think one's called ZIP. You can also obviously access your super, but there are many different forms of payment. So I would speak to a financial person at whichever clinic you go to.
Good luck, Lauren.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. It's expensive, Tricia, isn't it? I mean, that figure of $70,000 from our caller earlier, is that typical?
No.
You think it's more than most or less than most?
More than most.
Right.
But accessing donor sperm, or if you buy donor sperm from overseas or eggs from overseas, that's a big cost.
Right.
Also, being on the donor programs, you pay extra because you need to. There's a whole team that looks after those programs. You need to have counselling. You need to pay for the counselling. So there's a lot of extra things. But, you know, a routine your first IVF cycle in a calendar year out of pocket is generally around $5,000 to $6,000, because Medicare gives you a rebate. And at RepMed, we had our own what we call a safety net. There's also the Medicare safety net, but we had our own safety net where if you did a second or a third IVF cycle in a calendar year, they would be much cheaper.
So what you would say roughly, if you had, say, two or three cycles succeeded at the end of that, that you'd be up for what? Less than 20, do you think?
More probably than 20. If you had three cycles? It depends how much testing you've had first, or
give us a rough genetic
screening. But perhaps 20, 25.
Okay. All right, 1-300-800-222. Why is sperm so expensive, says my texter?
Well, if it comes from... We basically need more sperm locally because there are guidelines and laws that any child produced from donor sperm has to be able to contact...
To be contactable, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, is that not the case with, say, with the American sperm donation?
Well, any sperm that we take from America, they have to be able to do that.
To be contacted?
Yep. When the child is 16.
Is there any possibility, I mean, apart from doing it yourself, I suppose, of anonymous sperm donation then? In an Australian clinic?
No.
Right.
No. I mean, you're anonymous, but
you
have to be able to be contacted when the child is 16.
Why is this? I mean, I've heard this story before about the American sperm donors, that there is so much more information available about the sort of donor that you're using. Why is there less information about Australian donors?
I can't tell you that. I think it's a bit of a culture thing in America. They give you pages and pages and pages of, and some also give you photographs. But in Australia, you get a fair bit of information. You get, obviously, medical history, family history, physical characteristics, education, likes, not likes. You know, there is still quite a bit of information. Not as much as some of the American clinics, but you still get a lot of information. Why the difference, I can't answer.
Sophie says American donors are paid. Australian donors are not paid. Is that
right? That's right.
Yeah.
It's illegal to pay for donation in Australia.
Okay. Anne from Frankston. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty
lovely
good.
To speak to you.
Likewise.
I have a very, very long story, but I'll try and make it as short as possible. About 38, 39, I met my husband. We got pregnant naturally. I never thought I could have children. I was quite surprised, but then I had a miscarriage, and then I got the feeling that I just needed to be pregnant. A clock went off. I don't know what happened, but then I ended up going down the IVF route, and we had all sorts of things that gift. I can't tell you all the things that I went through, but then I had eggs checked, and my eggs, I called them hard-boiled because they were just no good. Mm. He said I had plenty of them, but they were no good. So I ended up with a donor egg. What happened was I was put on a list to maybe get an anonymous donor, which I did. I got pregnant with a donor egg. The egg age at that time was about 30, but I was 43. I had a baby when I was 44. He's now 22. But what happened in the meantime, when we were not having any success, I said to my husband, why don't you become a sperm donor because they're advertising. And so off he went, and he didn't get paid anything. He just had to do something in a jar and look at a magazine. And even 20 years later, it's still going. You can give to 10 families, including your own. So now he's got 10, I think it's about 10 offspring now. My husband would love to be contacted. He's put his name down and everything. We've had some limited contact with some people. It's been amazing because they've all looked like him. It's just, but it's been a wonderful experience. You know, as an older parent, you do feel it. But the thing is, you keep yourself young, and often because I looked a bit younger, it was a bit lucky because when we went to the school things, I just sort of blended in, so that wasn't a problem at all. It was a great experience, but as I said, I had the egg donor, but then he became the sperm donor. It's just, our story is quite a big, you know, there's all sorts of aspects to it, but I'd highly recommend it. I did get acupuncture at the time when I had the embryos put back in. I don't know whether it did seem to work for us, but the embryos that we were able to get was about 20 embryos, but Wow. Only the first one took. Yeah, it was from the donor egg. Mm. So the first one took. They put two back, and there were 10 cell embryos, very good embryos. And one took, the other one didn't. But then I just felt compelled that I needed to keep using them. So probably for the next 4 or 5 years afterwards, I tried in vain because I really just didn't. It was my own beliefs, I guess. I just did not want to leave them defrost on a shelf or, you know, I just felt that I needed to do that and I needed to do the right thing. That was my choice, but a lot of other people will feel differently and I don't judge that. But the thing is, as I said, our story is quite big and we've now met some of the donor
children.
Because, and from the donor egg, there was a girl born on that side. My son hasn't pursued that, but I'd like him to. Because there's, look, really, and my husband already had two children through his first marriage. So really, when I try and add it up, I think technically my son will probably have 14 half-siblings. And it's ironic because when he was very young, he used to say, oh, I want a brother or sister. And I couldn't tell him all this information. It was just going to be too much. And I thought one day I can share with him. And, you know, he has met a couple and he's actually, he's just a wonderful person, my son. He's he was just so, you know, accepting. He's so lovely, especially with younger kids. So it's working out okay.
Thanks, Anne. Good on you. Yeah. That's an interesting story.
It's a lovely story.
It's a lovely story. Thank you, Fran. Yeah. One of my texts says, what are the possible financial implications for sperm donors if you are contactable? I mean, that would probably concern a lot of donors, wouldn't it?
There are no financial implications.
Right.
Once you donate your sperm, you've donated your sperm, you have no legal rights to the child and neither does the child have legal rights to you.
And that's in Australian law, is it?
Yeah. That's Australian law, yes.
Mm. Okay, there we are. Yes, Robin says blood donors are paid in the USA and they're not here either. That is true. They're certainly not as a blood donor myself, yeah. All right, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Do you think it's going to get less expensive or not, Tricia? Probably not.
That's a very good question. In the last 5 years, it's probably got more expensive with the increase in genetics and genetic testing. And as the last caller alluded to, I had reproductive carrier screening, which is another $1,000 for the couple, roughly anywhere between sort of $400 and $1,000, depending where you have it, to determine whether or not you both carry a recessive gene and something that may affect the child. And there are extra processes that can be done now to determine whether an embryo carries a certain illness. So all of those things are more expensive. As opposed to routine IVF, we really haven't changed our prices very much, only really inflation over the last 5-10 years.
What are you allowed to choose if you're choosing a sperm donor? I mean, you say there's information available. I mean, are you able to say, look, you know, I want a tall one and I want these characteristics. I want blonde hair, for example, or
hair. I'm talking about genetic illnesses.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
No, but I'm talking about other genetic choices. I mean, are you allowed to make any in that sense?
No, because you can't tell that. You can't tell what a child is going to look like from an embryo. And, I mean, donor sperm or donor eggs, well, you've got your choice and what your donor looks like, that's up to you. But for yourselves, no, we can't even do sex selection in Australia. So if someone's had three boys and wants to have a girl, they have to go elsewhere. It's illegal in Australia.
Yeah, we're talking about fertility and the history of fertility with our specialist, Dr. Tricia Davies, a fertility clinician who's been in and around this area from basically the beginning, so has seen pretty much. Do you think there are improved technologies on the way? What's the future of it, Trish?
I think with all the genetics, that's sort of exploding. But there's some other things in the wind mitochondrial donation, because children born with a mitochondrial illness, devastating, they're very disabled. And in the United Kingdom now, one of the latest things is mitochondrial donation. So out of a fresh egg, the mitochondria is taken and put into the patient's egg. And in the United Kingdom, they've had 8 babies born from this new procedure. So this is, and we've got a group in Victoria that has been awarded a grant to look into mitochondrial donation. So that's getting underway and getting approvals and doing that. So that's a new big thing that would be fantastic once it's up and running here in Australia.
Apparently, sperm viability can be affected by, or there are some effects that are located in particular occupations. Now, we have a lot of truck drivers that listen to this program, and apparently, do they have some issue in relation to, as a group, in relation to sperm motility?
Yeah, there are a few occupations that can have a decrease in sperm counts, and a couple of funny things too. Yes, truck drivers, they are often, you know, they sit still all day. They sit in their truck, and therefore their testes are hotter. You know, the testes are outside the body for a reason, to be cooler. And heat decreases spermatogenesis.
Okay.
Also, there are other things like painters, exposure to toxins and chemicals. They may have a thing called DNA damage, a raised level of DNA damage in their sperm. And I've had a house painter whose level was 3 times the normal level, and we had to use donor sperm because no fertilisation worked because of the increase in DNA damage in his sperm. But there are also, Philip, some simple things. I had one patient who had very long, very hot baths every day. And when he first came to see me, this was in the late 90s in Wakefield Street, the sperm parameters weren't very good. So we stopped the long hot baths and they got spontaneously pregnant. So that's a good story.
Oh, well, there you are, gents. Gents, the free and breezy is probably the way, if you want to make it easy, I guess. Trish, it's been fascinating talking to you as well. Thanks for opening the window on this particular world, which has indeed proved life-changing for so many people. Our guest has been Dr. Tricia Davies, fertility clinician and a GP specialising in reproductive medicine. Thanks, Trish.
Yeah, thank you very much, Philip. There's lots more I'd love to say, but sadly, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Sadly, time has beaten us. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for the calls and texts as well. Sorry we couldn't get to everyone.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.